Hello, everyone. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome back to Faded Tales, everyone. This is a show where lost animals are not just names in textbooks, not just silhouettes in old illustrations, not just bones behind museums and glass, but characters with entire lives. I'm your host, Zoya, and today this is an episode I've wanted to tell you for a long time, because if you're new to this podcast, end of term, I record a special, instead of an endangered animal, I record an episode about an extinct one every semester, just to show you what was lost and so we can hopefully save many ones that have come. Last time I told you about the Tasmanian tiger, or thylacine. It was one of my favorite endangered animals. Now I found something that I think you guys might find unique. So sit back, relax, and I think this is the perfect day for a cup of hot cocoa or hot tea. It's such a nice hot drink, and like cuddling in a warm blanket, and wrapped in while you study. And you can listen to this while you study too. So sit back, relax, and let's get into today's episode. Now, I want to tell you about this creature that had vanished, that had belonged to a second category. Because these animals have disappeared, they felt like scientific footnotes, important, yes, but distant. And there are stolen animals whose vanishing, like the stolen myths, myths that are missing. Animals that feel almost too large, too powerful, too iconic to simply end. You don't think it's possible for this animal to end, but it has happened. And it has happened to this animal. It was a lion, but not just any lion. It was a lion whose mane fell like a black waterfall over his shoulders. A lion who moved through cedar forest, dusted it with snow. A lion whose roar bounced between steep mountain cliffs and echoed for miles. A lion whose image adorned palaces, mosaics, coins, and legends. A lion that emperors feared, poets praised, and hunters obsessed over. A lion that once ruled the mountains of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, I think that's how you pronounce it, sorry. until we stripped those mountains of him. Today we are exploring the life, the legend, and the loss of the Barbary lion, also called the Atlas lion or the Lion of the Moors, one of the most dramatic extinction stories ever recorded. Now, if you're picturing like the typical savannah lion, golden coat, short mane, open plains, erase that image out of your mind. Get it away. Because the Barbary lion was different. This was a lion sculpted by mountains, shaped by a winter, and carved out of shadow. It was a lion whose mane grew so long and so dark that early travelers swore they'd seen lions wearing cloaks made of night. A lion whose silhouette alone struck fear into soldiers. A lion that Roman emperors would pay fortunes to acquire. But nothing symbolized power quite like this animal. But before we dive into empire, mythology, colonial hunting, genetics, rewilding, and last lonely lions slipping through Atlas Mountain. I want you to picture a moment. Close your eyes, unless you're driving. Please don't close your eyes. But imagine this. And it's the year 1650. You're a traveler moving through the middle Atlas Mountains of Morocco. It's winter. Snow crushes beneath your horse's hooves. The cedar trees stand tall, black against the pale fog. You pull your cloak tighter around your shoulders. The air is bitter but clean. You guide a Berber man named Idris suddenly. Your guide, a Berber man named Idris, suddenly raises a hand. Your horse stops. The forest goes quiet, unnaturally quiet. Then something from somewhere deep in the valley, you hear it. A roar, not loud, not aggressive, just a single rolling, echoing sentence in the language of lions. Idris bows his head. That, he whispers, is the king of Atlas. And for a moment, you believe him completely, because that roar feels ancient, but like something older than the snow, older than the mountains, older than you. Now, fast forward 100 years. Villages expand, forests shrink, guns grow sharper, stories fade, and eventually that roar disappears. Not because the lion chose silence, because we forced it. Today, only a few preserved pelts remain, a few skulls, a few bones, genetic traces scattered like ashes in the wind. But is the barbary lion truly gone, or does it survive in hidden descendants? Are there still genes carrying its legacy? Was the last wild barbarian lion seen in 1942, or could some have lingered longer? These are the questions we will explore today. So the story begins in the aged forest, echoes through empires, and settles into the quiet places where extinct animals linger. This is a tale of the barbarian lion, the shadow of king of the Atlas. Now let's begin. Now, to understand the Barbary Lion, to understand why it looked the way it did, why it behaved the way it did, and why it became the symbol it became, and we need to go back, not just a few centuries, not even a few thousand years, but back through layers of history thick as stone. We are going to rewind millions of years to the origins of the lions themselves, because the Barbary Lion didn't just appear, it was shaped by geography, climate, and evolution, by pressures that squeezed and sculpted it into something distinct. Let's go to the very, very beginning. Long before humans ever set foot in North Africa, the continent was a stage for something of the world's most breathtaking predators. The earliest ancestors of modern lions emerged in Africa around 3.4 million years ago. These weren't lions as we pictured them. They were smaller, more leopard-like, more flexible than their ecology. Over time, some populations began expanding their range. But by about 500,000 years ago, lions had spread across Africa, into Europe, through the Middle East, into India, and even into the colder steppes regions of Serbia. Think about that for a moment. There were lions roaming the forests of England, lions stalking prey across the grassy plains of Greece, lions paddling through what is now Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan. This was a species that could adapt to anything, snow, desert, forest, heat. And in North Africa, something special happened. A lion population settled in the rugged mountains that curve across the continent like a spine, the Atlas Mountains. Isolated from other lions, challenged by weather patterns, new prey, and new terrain, they evolved into a unique form. This was the beginning of the Barbary Lion. To understand the Barbary Lion, we need to understand its home. The Atlas Mountains aren't soft, rolling hills. They are ancient, jagged, and dramatic. A collision of tectonic plates and a millennia of erosion. They stretch from Morocco to Tusnia, cutting through landscapes of cedar forests, cork oak woodlands, rocky cliffs, snowy passes, desert edges, deep gorges, and temperatures can swing wildly from scorching hot summers to freezing winters where snow blankets the entire valley. This is not a place where survival is easy. And predators can survive here, and the predators that survive here have to adapt. So they grow bigger to conserve heat. They develop thicker manes. They learn to stalk silently through dense forests, not open plains. They become ambush hunters rather than long-distance hunters, which is why the Barbary Lion developed the iconic that iconic long dark mane, a biological response to cold mountain winters. Some of the earliest European explorers who saw these lions described them as regal beyond description, beasts wearing black cloaks, or shadow lions. Their manes were so thick that in many cases they extended down to the belly, wrapping the animal in a kind of natural armor. This wasn't just beautiful, it was functional. The Barbary lion was a predator built for a harsh home. Anyway, predators do not evolve alone. They evolve alongside their prey. Let's step into the Atlas Mountains, found thousands of years ago, and look at who lived there. Barbary red deer, wild boar, Barbary sheep, North African aurochs, sorry, they're extinct wild cattle. Can't remember how to pronounce it, but anyway, there was wild goats, gazelles, and even the North African elephant and rhinoceros in very ancient times. Imagine that for a minute. A mountain range where you could see lions, bears, elephants, rhinos, leopards, hyenas, all living in overlapping territories. The ecosystem was rich, diverse, and full of giant mammals. The Barbary lion had to be strong enough to compete with all of them. It hunted in dense forests rather than grasslands, relying on stealth, strength, and short bursts of speed rather than the long distance chases we occasionally associate with savannah lions today. It also interacted with and sometimes clashed with other predators such as Atlas bears, Barbary leopards, wolves, striped hyenas. This predator-rich environment shaped the Barbary lion's behavior. It became more territorial, more solitary or pair-based, more stealth-oriented, and more nocturnal. Unlike savannah lions, which often hunt in large prides, the Barbary lion appears to have lived in much smaller groups, a male with 1 to 2 females, or a female with cubs hunting by herself. The mountain terrain made large prides inefficient. Too many mouths and not enough prey. Barbary lions survived by being clever, adaptable, and patient. Then humans arrived in North America tens of thousands of years ago. And from the very beginning, they were aware that the Barbary lion was different. In caves across the region, particularly in Morocco and Algeria, prehistoric people carved images of lions with oversized heads, dramatic manes, and body proportions more muscular than the modern lions we see today. Some cave paintings depict lions standing off against hunters. Others show lions in ritualistic contexts, suggesting that they were both feared and spiritually significant. To early humans, the Barbary lion wasn't just another animal. It was a presence, a force, a symbol, a threat, a protector, and a creature of meaning. As the human civilization grew, from early Berber societies to Carthaginian traders to the later Roman settlers, the lion's mythic status only increased. We'll explore more into these myths in a later section, but now let's imagine this. You're living thousands of years ago in a Barbary village all on the edge of the forest. At night, you hear a roar, deep, rolling, impossibly rich. The sound bounces off the cliffs and shakes the ground beneath you. It's not just a lion you hear, it's an announcement, a declaration that this land is shared, not owned, and that the mountains have another ruler, and you respect him. You must, because the Barbary lion is both a danger and balance. A creature that keeps the deer populations healthy, keeps the forest alive, keeps the ecosystem functioning. In many Berber traditions, the lion was seen as a guardian of the mountains, a being that kept the natural order intact. It wasn't just feared, it was respected. Now, let's go into the anatomy of this lion. I did go into a bit of it, but I want to go into it a bit deeper. So let's break it down and separate... And let's see what separates the Barbary lion from its more familiar relatives. Let's go with the mane first. Let's start with the mane. The mane was longer than any other lion subspecies. It was dark, often completely black, which is what I've mentioned before. It was covered, it covered the shoulders, the chest, and the stomach, and sometimes formed a so-called cape around it, reaching halfway down its back. The cold mountain winters encouraged its evolution, of course. And then there's the size. The Barbary lions were large. Males were around 420 to 500 pounds, while the females were 250 to 350 pounds. Some exceptional males reportedly reached 550 pounds. Not the absolute biggest lions ever recorded, but still significantly larger than many savannah lions. Now, the behavior, I mentioned that they're small, they have smaller prides, but they're more, there's more solitary males in anything. There's more, they more ambush-based hunting. There's stronger attachment to the forested areas and more territorial along narrow mountain passes. Now, with their personality, ancient accounts describe Barbary lions as unusually bold, calm but intimidating, relentless when defending territory, and less tolerant of humans approaching them. Travelers wrote that these lions stared down humans with unsettling intelligence. That is poetic exaggeration or truth, we may never know, but many independent accounts say the same thing. Barbary lions had had presence, magnetic, commanding, almost supernatural. Now, as the human populations expanded in North America, interactions with lions became more frequent, sometimes peaceful, sometimes deadly. They wanted it for stories. They wanted it for protection rituals. They wanted it to symbolize kings. They wanted it as trophies. They wanted it in arenas, and they wanted it for power. This desire, this human fascination, is what eventually sealed the Barbary lion's fate. But we're not there yet. Before extinction, before hunting, before colonialism, there were empires, and one empire in particular would shape the lion's destiny more than any other. Rome. It's the year 80. The Colosseum is brand new, gleaming white under the sun. And marble pillars, bronze statues, banners snapping in the wind, 50,000 Romans pouring in, buzzing with excitement. Now imagine being a visitor from one of these Rome provinces, say North America, where your ancestors considered the Barbary lion a sacred creature. And now you find yourself watching that lion dragged into the arena, tormented, slaughtered for entertainment. Rome was unsettled. This wasn't just a show. This was propaganda carved in blood. The empire wanted you to understand. Rome is strong to capture the king of the beasts. Rome is ruthless enough to destroy what other cultures fear and respect. Rome controls nature, people, and the world. The Colosseum wasn't just built for sports. It was built for messages. Now, let's talk about emperors. Some liked philosophy, some liked war, some liked whatever Caligula was doing. Anyway, but almost all of them loved spectacles. For emperors like Commodus, the Barbarian lion became a prop in their personal mythology. Commodus would walk into the arena dressed as Hercules, the club-wielding demigod who famously defeated the Nemean lion. He wasn't just pretending to be a hero. He was reenacting the myth with real living lions. And here's a historical detail textbooks often ignore. Commodus didn't fight these lions fairly. They were drugged, tied down, starved, wounded beforehand. Rome admired bravery, but it adored power more. So when Commodus killed a lion with a single thrust of its spear, even if the lion could barely lift its head, the message to the public was clear. The emperor conquers what even the gods struggled with. Symbolically, politically, and emotionally, the lion became a mirror reflecting the emperor's image back at the people. Now here's the fascinating part. Romans weren't passive observers. They participated, screaming, cheering, commenting loudly like it was a football match. For many in the crowd, the lion represented the dangers of the wildness, the chaos outside civilization, the threats Rome protected them from, quote unquote. Seeing the lion die wasn't just thrilling, it was reassuring. It reinforced the ideas that Roman order triumphed over nature's chaos. A scholar once said the arena was the classroom of the empire. If that's true, then the lion was a lesson plan. Now, let's step away from the arena for a moment. Let's imagine the lion's perspective. Barbarian lions were ambush hunters, territorial, emotionally intelligent. They lived in mountains, mountain forests, raised families, defended their land. They weren't roaring monsters. They rarely roared at all in the wild. But in Rome, they became caricatures, symbols of savagery, props in political theater. The tragedy here is not only death, it's misunderstanding. Because while Romans celebrated their victory, they never truly grasped what they were destroying. The barbarian lion wasn't Rome's enemy. It wasn't even a villain. It was simply an animal trying to live. And soon it would disappear from the very places that once feared and worshipped it. Now, let's go backstage. Backstage, behind the roar of the crowd, behind the flood of gladiators, prisoners, and performers, there was chaos. Lions were dragged through cramped corridors, whipped, beaten, starved to provoke aggression. They were kept in tunnels under the arena, known as the hippogram, or hippogram. I hope I pronounced that right, but I probably didn't. I'm not a history major. I wish I was. Damp, permanently dark, echoing with the streaks of other animals. Think about this. Lions are built for open space, territory, sunlight, not stone tunnels. So their fear, their panic, their desperation, these emotions shaped how they fought in the arena. When the Romans interpreted what the Romans interpreted as ferocity was often just terror. The Colosseum floor was a stage, but the backstage was a nightmare. Rome used animals, many animals, bears, elephants, leopards, wolves, but lions were special. Why? Because lions held a universal meaning. They represented royalty in Africa. They symbolized bravery for Greeks, and they embodied danger to Europeans. By conquering the lion, Rome was symbolically conquering everyone else's mythology. The message wasn't just Rome is strong. It was your gods, your symbols, we break them for entertainment. A subtle, devastating form of cultural domination. And here's the quiet irony in all this. Romans also associated lions with uncontrolled wildness, yet they were the ones who destroyed entire ecosystems to fuel their games. Romans claimed lions represented barbarism, while they themselves engaged in mass killing for entertainment. Romans admired Hercules for defeating the Nemean lion, but lined up to watch a drugged barbarian lion collapse in front of them. This is where history becomes uncomfortable, but it also where it becomes important. Now we spent the last, I spent you to talk the last like few minutes talking about the inside of a stone belly of the Roman Empire, the lions in cages, the lions on sand, the lions of tools, propaganda. But to understand what there was really lost, we have to step out of the Colosseum and into the wild world these lions actually came from. Because before the Roman Empire decided to, the lion was a symbol of imperial domination. It was a living, breathing, complex creature inhabiting one of the most beautiful ecosystems on Earth. When people imagine Africa, they think of savannas, flat grasslands, acacia trees, sunsets. But the barbarian lion did not live there. Its world was completely different. The barbarian lion, Panthera leo, belonged to the mountains. Picture the Atlas Mountains stretching from Morocco to Tunisia, rugged snow crapped in the winter, hot and fragrant with pine in summer. Mist rolls in from the Mediterranean. Forests grow so dense the sunlight falls in the thin green strips across the ground. This is where the barbarian lion lived. Not in the gold plains, not in the desert dunes, but in the cool mountain forests, tangled ravines, cedar groves, oak woodlands, and high cliffs, where the wind howled. Lion in the Atlas Mountains was not merely a predator, it was a part of a world built on silence and shadow. Hunting in the Atlas Mountains meant something hunting meant something totally different from hunting on the savannah. There were no wild open plains, no long-distance chases, no dramatic ambushes beneath acacia trees. Instead, lions hunted many of the animals I mentioned before, but I'll mention them again. There were wild boar, barbary deer, gazelles, and monkeys occasionally, not really, and cattle or horses when no wild prey was scarce. But the real difference lay in their strategy. They used the terrain like ghosts, hiding behind boulders, stalking through the thick cedar underbrush, leaping from steep slopes, using fog and darkness as camouflage. A lion's roar echoes differently in the mountain forest. It's deepest, shorter, more muffled, molded by the trees. And here's the twist. Barbary lions rarely roared at all. Why? Well, that's because the roaring gave away their position. And the Atlas Mountains rewarded silence. Rome believed the lion was a creature of noise and drama. Nature made it a creature of quiet power. Barbary lions didn't form massive prides. I already mentioned this. anyway, I already mentioned it. Like, there was one dominating male, one or two females, cubs, or older offspring that haven't dispersed yet. And it was, like, more intimate. It was more closer, more dependent on cooperation and learning. Cubs grew navigating dense forests, learning not just how to hunt, but how to disappear. In a world where humans became an increasing threat, stealth became as essential as claws. The Romans never saw this side of them. They only saw the animal dragged into a cage after days or weeks without food. But in the wild, the barbary lion wasn't a monster. It was a parent, a hunter, a creature deeply woven through the ribbon of its environment. Before the Roman Empire ever stepped foot in the region, the peoples of North Africa had a relationship with the barbary lion that was complex and layered. The ancient Numidia and Mauritania. I don't think I pronounced that right. They were a symbol of royalty. Kings wore lion imagery to show legitimacy and protection. And stories describe the lions as guardians and of the mountains, protectors of springs and sacred places. And people understood that lions were dangerous, but also necessary. Lions kept wild boar populations under control, which protected crops. And farmers feared lions, hunters respected them, storytellers celebrated them. Human-lion conflict existed, yes, but it was not nothing like what the Romans would later impose. It was coexistence, tense, imperfect, but still coexistence. Once the Romans entered North Africa, the lion world shifted. Massive hunts were organized not for survival, but for spectacle. Roman trappers fanned out across mountains, capturing lions by the thousands. Some lions were taken as cubs, so they survived the journey. Some were caught in pits. Some were trapped in nets or driven into special enclosures. But the impact on the ecosystem was immediate. Prey species exploded in numbers. Farmers lost crops. Boars overran farmland. Forests changed shape. The lion wasn't just the only victim. The entire balance of the Atlas Mountains trembled. Remember, lions reproduce slowly. A lioness has one litter every 2 to 3 years. A few decades of Roman extraction was enough to push local population into collapses. This wasn't hunting. This was industrial removal. Rome saw lions as resources. North Africans saw lions as part of life. The lions themselves saw humans as threats. Nature was losing. Imagine, and now I'm going to talk about the last lion. Imagine a lone male barbary lion standing across standing at the edge of a snowy cliff. The wind cuts across its thick mane. Below him lies a dark forest still untouched by Roman hands. This was a lion's world in its final centuries. Retreat, adaptation, silence. As Roman territories expanded, lions moved deeper into remote ravines, high elevation woods, rugged cliff valleys. They lived on the edge of disappearance long before they became officially extinct. Their prey was shrinking. Their safety was shrinking, but they held on because survival wasn't just instinct. It was identity. After Rome had collapsed, North Africa began to breathe again, though. The mass export of lions stopped, the arenas emptied, the demand evaporated. for the first time in centuries, the barbarian lion was being shipped across the Mediterranean in cages. For a moment, there was a space for the lions to recover. But the damage had been done. Roman hunters had already fractured populations. Lions lived in small, isolated pockets. The genetic diversity had dropped, and the remaining lions were extremely wary of humans. In that time that followed, under Berberic dynasties and early Islamic rule, the lions were still respected, still feared, but far less persecuted. They appeared on royal crests. They lived in forests close to human settlement. They hunted livestock sometimes, but they also hunted boar, keeping ecosystems stable. For a few centuries, the barbarian lion wasn't thriving, but it was surviving. And then came the next great shift. Around 1500, something entered North Africa that changed everything. Firearms. Before guns, hunting a lion was risky. Even skilled hunters would hesitate, and the lions had advantage in steep terrain. But with firearms, a lion suddenly became easier to kill from a distance, wealthier to kill even, because pellets were valuable, and safer to kill because hunters no longer had to approach them physically. Reports from the era noted that the number of lions began to fall more noticeably. Gunshots echoed through forests where once only claws and hooves made noise. And then came something even more devastating. And it was 1983. France invaded Algeria. Yeah, this moment, the single historical pivot was the beginning of the end of the barbarian lion. Because colonial expansion wasn't just about land, it was about control. And the lions became symbols of wilderness, danger, and rebellion, exactly what the colonial forces wanted to eliminate. French generals labeled the barbarian lion as the enemy. Newspapers romanticized the lion hunts. Military officers were often seen killing lions as trophies and proof of loyalty to the empire. Suddenly, every large predator became a target, and the number backed this up. By 1840, French officers recorded over 100 lions killed per year in Algeria alone. By 1840 that over 100 lions were killed per year in Algeria alone. And then in 1850, just 10 years later, the number kept climbing even higher. Hunting wasn't only a threat. It was forests were being cut down for timber, and villages expanded as well. Wolves were even carved through lion territory, and livestock farming grew, and wild prey populations crashed too. The lion wasn't just being hunted; its entire world was being dismantled. Imagine a lion standing at the edge of a clearing where trees once stood, now replaced by military outposts and burning brush. The world as we knew it, collapsing in real time. That's what the barbarian lion faced. By the 1800s, colonial authorities introduced a bounty system. You kill a lion, you get money. It was that simple, and it was devastating. Farmers who once coexisted with lions now had financial incentive to kill them. Soldiers joined in. Professional hunters arrived from Europe to collect trophies. Some communities even held competitions. Who could kill the largest male? Who could bring back the biggest pelt? And who could pose the most dramatic photograph? Photography was new, and hunting photographs were fashionable. The barbarian lion's death became a postcard, literally. Lions were no longer just animals. They were content. But here's something colonizers didn't expect. The lion became a symbol of resistance. Local communities began to see the lion not just as a predator, but as a representation of identity, freedom, and the original land. Stories grew. Lions visiting holy men. Lions guarding mountain passes. Lions pushing the unjust. Lions appearing as omens before battle. Colonial authorities hated this. An animal that inspired pride and rebellion? Unacceptable. So they doubled down. More hunting, more bounties, more campaigns to eradicate the threat. The lion wasn't just fighting extinction, it was fighting an empire. By the 1890s, barbarian lions were no longer common. Seeing them were rare. And they did happen, and each one became almost a myth, almost like mythical. A report in 1893 described a lioness near a waterfall in Arias Mountains. Another 1898 record shows a male records a male crossing a snowy ridge in Tanzania. French officers described hearing roars echoing through fog at dawn, roars they considered haunting, unnatural, and ancient. Newspapers romanticized the last lions, presenting them as symbols of fading wilderness. But these stories, beautiful as they are, were warnings. The barbarian lion was becoming a ghost long before it vanished. By the early 20th century, the barbarian lion had been reduced to a handful of isolated survivors in Algerian mountains, Morocco's high Atlas, and Tunisia forests. Their territories were fragmented. Their prey was scarce. Their numbers were critically low, and then became the final brawl. Rifles became cheaper. Roads reached remote areas. Deforestation accelerated. A lion once roared across free countries now survived only in the most rugged and inaccessible places. The mountain lion had been pushed to the edges of its own kingdom. As we enter 1920s to 1940s, sightings became so rare that each one reads like a ghost story. Shepherd glimpsed a lion moving through fog. A woman collecting firewood hears a low growl behind cedar trees. Is a hunter here finds enormous paw prints after snowfall. But most sightings end in the same way. A lion is tracked, a shot rings out, a pelt is displayed. Modern conservationists call this period the silent extinction, because unlike the mammoth or the dodo, the barbarian lion did not vanish suddenly. It faded slowly, painfully, quietly, and the world changed around it. The last confirmed sighting of a wild barbarian lion is generally listed as 1942 in Morocco, but eyewitness reports continue for decades after. We'll get to that later, I think. I don't know if I have that on my list. But anyway, for now, what matters, the barbarian lion did not die because nature failed it. It died because humans changed faster than the lion could adapt. The forests were cut, its prey disappeared, its mountains filled with guns, its world shrank into nothing. Extinction is supposed to be a clear line, a moment, a date in the calendar. On the calendar, it says this is when the animal ends. But the truth is, that's not normally how extinction almost. That's almost never how extinction works. Species do not just vanish in a single second. They fade. They blur. They leave beneath shadows. Memories, sightings, rumors, long after science declare the last chapter close. And barbarian lion, in more than almost any extinct animal, exists in that gray space. That eerie in-between world where history and folklore overlap. I'm gonna talk to you about like the little last section, and of like the last confirmed kills and the mysterious reports of the barbarian lion. If you open your textbooks, they will say that the last wild librarian was killed in 1942 near Morocco. A male lion shot by a local hunter, his body brought into town, photographed, documented, end of story. But it doesn't end there, because almost immediately after 1942, the sightings still continued. 1948, 6 years after the last lion, a shepherd in the High Atlas reported hearing a deep rolling roar echo through the ravine at dusk. When asked why he was so sure it was a lion, he said, "A bear growls, a panther cries, only a lion speaks." He wasn't alone. Woodcutters, hunters, and travelers describe similar sounds. Heavy footsteps, a low growling hum, strange movements in the fog, large footprints in wet soil. Some sightings were dismissed, some came from respected elders and experts, but none were confirmed with photographs. In extinction science, this gray area is known as the Elvis problem. Everyone claims to have seen the king long after the king is gone. But then, again, sometimes the king isn't gone. One of the most credible post-extinction sightings occurs in 1956. A French forestry officer and two assistants traveling nearby spotted a tawny female moving through tall grass with a cub approximately 6 months old. They were so certain of the sighting, they filed a formal report. No one believed them. But here's the interesting part. These men were trained wildlife observers. They had seen lions before. They knew the difference between a lioness and a hyena or a leopard. Their careers depended on accuracy. Their story remains consistent for decades. Was it real? We can't prove it. But it was, if it was, it means the Barbarian Lion survived at least 14 years longer than records claim. One of the most haunting pieces of evidence came from 1963 in the Middle Atlas Mountains. A Moroccan biologist conducting winter field work found a set of four tracks. They were round, wide, perfectly shaped, unmistakably feline, and larger than any known leopard. He took plaster casts and sent them to European experts. Their conclusion? Highly likely lion. But they didn't want to publish their finding. Why? Because saying a species that was extinct wasn't actually extinct would cause scientific embarrassment. So the casts were boxed, placed in storage, and quietly forgotten. Somewhere in the lab, those plasters still exist. Then, throughout the 1970s, multiple people in the communities in remote Atlas valleys spoke of lions. Elders described lions seen drinking at springs, tracks near herding routes, a male with a dark mane crossing a ridge at dawn. Most elders refused to name the exact locations, not because they were unsure, but because they did not want hunters to find these survivors. It was an unspoken rule in rural North Africa. If you know a rare animal that still lives in your mountains, do not tell outsiders. Some researchers believe that science kept the last lions alive for years. That silence kept the last lions alive for years. There was also another one. Can you believe it? In 1884, a British team of biologists traveled through a remote area of Morocco Eastern High Atlas. When camping near a cliff, they reportedly saw a large dark maned male moving slowly along a distant ridge, briefly silhouetted against the dust sky. They grabbed cameras. The lion disappeared behind rocks. No photo, no proof. Just one of the most credible eyewitnesses descriptions ever recorded. One scientist wrote, "What we saw that evening was either a barbarian lion or a ghost of one." This quote appears in his private field notes, not in scientific publications. Why private? Because no scientist wants to be the one claiming to see a ghost. Now, this is where it gets controversial. Some conservationists believe that the last wild lion may have survived until the in 1980s, or possibly early 1990s. This is because rural communities continued reporting, and the fresh texts kept being found. Livestock were kills appeared lion-like, not leopard-like. Multiple sightings came from tamed forestry staff. No leopards in the region were large enough to match descriptions, but without photos or bodies, the scientific world remains skeptical. Well, still, the question remains, if the Barbarian Lion didn't go extinct in 1942, when did it? Some say 1956, some say 1963, some whisper 1984, others say 1990. And maybe some quietly, cautiously say, maybe there are still some left. Not enough to repopulate, not enough to sustain a genetic line, but perhaps one or two, hidden in somewhere in the remote valleys. So animals don't announce their extinction. Sometimes they slip away without witnessing. Why do final sightings matter so much? Because extinction is emotional. When an animal disappears, humans feel grief, and the grief looks for hope. Sometimes sightings are real. Sometimes they're misidentifications. Sometimes, frankly, they're just stories people want to believe. But with the Barbarian Lion, the rumors persist for a reason. The mountains where the last lions lived are enormous, dense, foggy, remote, filled with deep ravines. A small, shy population could have survived out of sight for decades. And unlike a massive animal like a mammoth or a giant bird, lions are experts at not being seen. To this day, lions in India Gir Forest disappear into plain sight with shocking ease. Tigers vanish in forest so furtively that even drones can't find them. So the idea that a Barbarian Lion could have persisted in the Atlas Mountains for decades is not fantasy. It's ecologically possible. Now, for a moment, I want you to imagine a scene. It's early winter, 1989, You hear the word, you hear the deep roar of the lion. Like, everything freezes for a second. It's not just once. It's not a roar. It's not a scream. It's just a breath of a roar. Too old and too tired to rise to full strength. Shepherd's eyes widen in the whisper of the single word, lion. And the sound is gone. Maybe the moment happened. Maybe it didn't. But somehow something left those footprints in the snow. Someone moved through those forests. Someone kept the legend alive longer than records extended. Now, I think I want to bring your attention to the barbarian lion a little bit. Just give me a second to look up an image. I want to make sure I'm right. The last photograph ever was of the wild lion in Atlas Mountains was taken by Marceline Flandrin. And in 1925, that was the last photo ever. It's a large faraway shot. The lion is in the snow, and it's like very far away. You can barely make out the silhouette, but it's really dark. Like, the footprints are behind it. It's amazing to see so many. Animals in the wild. It's such a beautiful animal. You wouldn't think it would be real, like, to see a lion in the mountains, but it is. Anyway, this is it. Yeah, that was the story of the barbarian lion. It was an extinct, it was an amazing animal, but it sadly is extinct now, for sure. All these hopes, we don't know exactly when it went extinct, but it's gone for good, though. But it's still in our memories, and it's kind of like a lesson to us that all these efforts that we put into now kind of makes this like a memorable place. It's like kind of like righting our wrongs in history, because history is cruel. But sometimes we can make the world a better place and change history, change the fact that we can save an animal, change our ways. Anyway, this is Zoya, and I'll see you guys next semester for a new season of Faded Tales. I hope you guys enjoyed, and I hope you guys have a great time on your exams. Good luck, and goodbye.